possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Philip Graham is with us this afternoon to talk about poetry. He'll share with us some of the poems he's been enjoying this summer. He'll also answer our questions and respond to our comments about poets and poetry. So I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with the telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Philip Graham is a professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he serves as director of the Creative Writing Program. He is also the fiction editor for the university literary magazine, Ninth Letter. His books include two collections of short stories, The Art of the Knock and Interior Design, and a novel, How to Read an Unwritten Language. His stories have been published in many magazines, including The New Yorker, The Washington Post Magazine, and Chicago Review. Philip is a frequent guest on AM 580. He appears from time to time on Focus 580 and this program to talk about fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And it's a great pleasure to welcome him back the program. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Thanks very much.
I should begin with a disclaimer, though, that I am not a poet. I don't even play one on TV. I simply love to read poetry. And maybe that is aided by the fact that, I'm a writer, and I like to read writing that excites me and challenges me and delights me. But I also find very often that when I'm reading poetry, I wonder, why doesn't everybody read this poem? I mean, this is, wow, this is a great poem. Mm-hmm. I wish everybody could hear this. And I find that sometimes you mention poetry and people, though they're still standing in front of you as you're mentioning it, their feet are invisibly running as far away from you as possible. That some people really are terrified of poetry. I'm not sure where that comes from, bad teaching or, I don't know what it is. And, when they're in elementary school or junior high school, they don't get the right poetry to take a look at, or it's taught as if it were a puzzle or something difficult, and they'll be stupid or foolish if they don't get the secret point. But
yeah,
I've never seen that at all as what poetry is about. I've seen poetry really as a process by which, windows are sort of magically, invisibly opened up inside you, so you can not only look outside, but you can look deeper inside.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I think it is at once very personal and yet very universal.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what did you bring with you today?
Well, I was going to read one poem, but I think I'm going to read another one. And it's one, not the one, Celeste, that we talked about before the show. It's by Theodore Deppe, but it's a poem called For Caitlin, Setting Off to See the World Without Her Coat.
Okay.
And the reason why I'd like to maybe start that up because of something that you just said, which is it doesn't have to be about us to be about us. And this is a poem by a man who is trying to accustom himself to the thought of his daughter leaving home and seeking her life out into the world. And I know that I'm starting to deal with that. My son is going to graduate from high school next year, and I'm already partially mourning his absence. And I know right now, especially, there are a lot of parents who are about to or have just said goodbye to their children going off to college. And so I think this is the kind of poem that will very much speak to people, even though, you know, they don't have a daughter named Caitlin and they are not Theodore Deppe, the poet. One thing I should mention before reading this is there's a reference to Thomas Hardy, the famous English author, whose body was buried in Westminster, but his heart was buried in the moorland where he lived. And there's a reference to that. For Caitlin setting off to see the world without her coat. Let the heart go then. Let the heart seek its landscapes, knowing nothing but its own desire. No, not even knowing that. No plans except to fill herself with as much world as possible. Bulgaria, because of a gypsy wedding dance heard years ago. And Wessex, maybe, quote, to visit Thomas Hardy, unquote. No forwarding address. When did the heart ever leave one? Oh, Thomas Hardy, her red toothbrush is gone from the mug by the sink. And it's strange and almost funny, the story she told about your cat. She said the vicar's compromise allotted your body to Westminster to satisfy the nation, while your heart was to be tucked in beneath the green yew tree surrounded by moorland you loved. Strange about the cat. After the country doctor's bonesaw cracked the sternum's parapet, after he snipped a gate into the pericardium, then reached into the smooth cave of the thorax and severed the heart, like a trussed chicken, but smaller, like the body of a thrush. After he lifted the glistening thing into the light, he covered it, even in January there are flies, carefully, with a tea cozy. And when they had taken away the body, and when the heart sat in state, waiting for the little coffin to be made, and the hayride across the heath to the village churchyard, then the double-pawed calico, the author's favorite cat, smelled out the choice meat and dragged it from the table, cameling its back at the parlor maid's approach, refusing to release the heart, gripping tightly as the maid seized the broom and shrieked, "Oh, daughter, how is it done? How do I let the heart go?"
Theodore Deppe. And that is for Caitlin setting off to see the world without her coat.
And that's from Cape Clear, his new and selected poems. Hmm.
I can't remember who it was now, but I remember in a course in literature, the instructor said something about someone saying to have a daughter is like to have a needle through one's heart.
Oh.
And I might not...
Not my daughter.
I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know, I know. Yeah, yeah.
It's wonderful, and yet it is. It's fraught with seeing them off.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Well, and there's another poem where we see, as a child grows, we see the heartache of a parent.
Ah, that's Bridget Kelly's poem from The Orchard. Let's go to that, okay? Right. This is a wonderful poem. It's from her latest book, The Orchard, just published. And Bridget Kelly, and it's the first book in the poem, in the book of poetry. It's called Black Swan. I told the boy I found him under a bush. What was the harm? I told him he was sleeping and that a black swan slept beside him. The swan's feathers hot, the scent of the hot feathers and of the bush's hot white flowers, as rank and sweet as the stewed milk of a goat. The bush was in a strange garden, a place so old it seemed to exist outside of time. In one spot, great stone steps leading nowhere. In another, statues of horsemen posting giant stone horses along a high wall. And here were triangular beds of flowers, flush with red flowers, and there circular beds flush with white. And in every bush and bed flew small birds and the cries of small birds. I told the boy I looked for him a long time, and when I found him, I watched him sleeping, his arm around the swan's moist neck, the swan's head tucked fast behind the boy's back, the feathered breast and the bare breast breathing as one, and then very swiftly and without making a sound, so that I would not wake the sleeping bird, I picked the boy up and slipped him into my belly, the way one might slip something stolen into a purse, and brought him here. And so it was. And so it was. A child with skin so white, it was not like the skin of a boy at all, but like the skin of a newborn rabbit, or like the skin of a lily, pulseless and thin. And a giant bird with burning feathers, and beyond them both a pond of incredible blackness, overarched with ancient trees and patterned with shifting shades, the small wind in the branches making a sound like the knocking of 1,000 wooden bells, things of such beauty. But still I might have forgotten, had not the boy, who stands now to my waist, his hair a cap of shining feathers, come to me today weeping because some older boys had taunted him and torn his new coat. Had he not, when I bent my head to his head, said softly but with great anger, "I wish I had never been born. I wish I were back under the bush," which made the old garden rise up again, shadowed and more strange. Small birds running fast, and the grapple of chill coming on. There was the pond half circled with trees, and there the flowerless bush. But there was no swan. There was no black swan. And beneath, the sound of the wind, I could hear dark and low, the giant stone hooves of the horses, striking and striking the hardening ground.
And that's Bridget Kelly, Black Swan, from a collection called The Orchard.
Such a powerful poem.
Yeah, yeah.
The end of childhood, in a sense, for a child, but also the end of the beautiful fantasy of childhood in some way in the mind of the parent, you know?
Yeah, that comes through in the way that we're led into the poet's life here, I think, in terms of she's done it. She's incorporated some magic.
Yeah, an inner landscape.
Yeah.
She believes, in a sense, the story she's told her son almost as much as she has, you know, in a way. Or at least it comes back to her when she realizes the strength of his own belief in that story. Yeah.
One of the things I love about this poem is the image of the swan's head tucked fast behind the boy's back, the feathered breast and the bare breast breathing as one, and then very swiftly and without making a sound so that I would not wake the sleeping bird, I picked the boy up and slipped him into my belly.
Yeah.
The way one might slip something stolen into a purse.
Yeah, it's like Jack and the Beanstalk in a way, you know, getting the golden goose.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a beautiful myth, a little private myth between mother and child.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about this particular poet. She's here at the U of I.
Yes, Bridget Kelly has been here for a number of years. This is her third book, and I don't know what to say except I adore her work. In fact, I admire the work of all of my poetry colleagues in the program, three of whom have published books this year, not only Bridget, but Michael Van Walligen, his new and selected poems, and Larry Lieberman, who has published a book, though I'm not going to be reading from it today because it's not here. It's in the mail. He published a book with a British press that was based on his poems that were echoing things that he saw in the work of two Caribbean artists. And so it's a beautiful book with all the paintings that he writes about and the poems in the book. But it's not here yet, so I'll do that some other time. But,
okay.
We also have Michael Madonick, who is writing poems towards his next book, and there's some wonderful ones there.
Yeah, very good. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Writer Philip Graham is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's not a poet, but he loves poetry.
I love poetry.
And he visits us here at AM 580 from time to time to talk about fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. He's a professor of English at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions comments. Here are the telephone numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL.
You know, another thing about poetry, and too, and I found when I was younger, it took me a hard time to learn this. Growing up as I did reading prose, that I think if you do a lot of that, the impulse is to read a poem as if it were prose, to kind of get through it quickly, on to the next poem, you know, and so forth, and read your way through, and I finished that book, you know, and that's not the way poetry works. Poetry basically says, time to slow down, you know, and guess what? You can read this another time if you'd like, you know. In fact, for certain books, and the one book that I've really been reading over and over again this summer, and just starting to get into some of the others here, has been this book by Theodore Deppe, and I must say I've read some poems 10 or 15 times, and the impact sometimes deepens even more with each reading. And I think, you know, it's a good way to maybe to read a book of poetry if you're interested out there and you haven't done it very often or not much at all, is simply allow a poem to capture you, you know, and take some time with it. And it's not that it's a puzzle. I mean, I think the poems that I've read already today are immediately perceivable emotionally. You know what that poem is about. You can feel the power of it. But when you go back, as you just did when you were talking about this image and that image in Bridget's poem, you realize that there's so much richness of language that, in fact, your pleasure in the experience grows and expands. And that's really what it is, not to say, gee, I did the crossword puzzle today. I mean, that's not what it's about, you know. But instead that I found more richness and deepness in a work of art that somebody, in a sense, wrote for me. They, you know, she wrote it or he wrote it for him or herself, but they wrote it for me too.
Yeah. Poetry is very concentrated, I find. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost, you can almost, if you're really in a space with that poem for a while, it can be overwhelming, I think.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you're in a greenhouse full of lilies.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the essence of those flowers is just overpowering.
Yeah.
So true. You have to say, wait a minute, one flower at a time.
Mm-hmm. One flower at a time, right, yeah. Exactly. You know, same thing if you go to a museum. If you march through the museum, you'll end up seeing nothing. You know, you have to somehow go into that room sometimes which has 20 or 30 paintings on the walls and the four walls, and the one that calls to you is the one that calls to you and that you have to answer the call.
Mm. So today we're not doing the Louvre.
No. No.
Isn't that what Chevy Chase did in one of his films,
Oh, really?
American
No, I
Vacation or something?
Yeah. Yeah, you don't do it with running shoes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of, mm-hmm. you know, of how you can approach a poem or the fact that you read it and it's not a crossword puzzle and it there is an immediate aha.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on you can find other things there. But there is a poem... Ruffel.
Yes.
I don't know, should I share the last two lines of this poem before you read it?
I'll read it, and then we can talk.
Right.
Or do you... Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm still that kind of guy that doesn't want to give away the ending, you know?
Okay. That's my,
I should say, I also teach, besides being here, insane that I am, I also teach as a visiting faculty member at the Low Residency MFA program at Vermont College, and I do some residencies there in the winter and the summer, and Mary Ruffel is one of my colleagues there, and she is a real original. This actually is going to be a mild poem, though it has its quirkiness. She's extraordinarily quirky, and in my opinion, she's the 20th, or I guess now I would have to say the 21st century version of Emily Dickinson in many ways. And she publishes a lot, about a book every year or two, and they're very original. They're very sort of strange and mystical and funny very often, really hysterically funny, but in the quirkiest and wildest way. She's a poet I really admire. And, you know, you might even get a sense of that from the title that this poem comes from, called Among the Musk Ox People. But this poem that you were mentioning is called The Raft. There are two people alone on the raft. I am one of them. One speaks only English, the other Chinese. That much is understood. By the eyes, by the cut of the swimsuits. It is too bad. I feel regret. This is the person I have chosen to tell my life story to. How big is the lake? How big is the raft? If 100 people swam in the lake, it would be crowded. If only 6 came to the raft would be crowded. But there are only 2, and someone swimming in the far water away from the raft, waving regularly. Both of us notice the swimmer. From our floating, splintered world, we see the exertion. I stretch out my back. There is room for that. And the other stretches out on her stomach. There is room for that. I close my eyes, and the other one closes hers. How do I know? There are some things you don't have to know to be sure of.
Those are the two last lines.
What a kicker. Yeah. Mm.
There are some things you don't have to know to be sure of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wish I had that in my quiver as a kid.
See, that's why you're supposed to be reading poetry, everybody. It helps you.
Yeah. When you teach students fiction writing, mm-hmm. Do you study poetry in your classes as a way to look at metaphor? And
I have tried.
Mm-hmm.
I have tried. And I must say that it has never been particularly successful because I find that students who are not poetry writers, by and large, lock up when they see a poem on the page. I would find that my students who could be incredibly eloquent, I'm talking about undergraduate students primarily here, could be incredibly eloquent when speaking about a story, had nothing to say about a poem. And again, I think it was this terrifying fear that there were actually a million words behind the 100 words on the page of the small poem. And because they couldn't possibly figure out how to unlock those million words, they were afraid of appearing stupid. And I found myself increasingly still trying to do it, finding simpler and simpler poems so that we could start somewhere. And I found that it was almost impossible to do it. And that's really one of the impulses for my wanting and being very happy to read some poems over the air here is just to say, you know, it's okay, calm down. You know, this is really enjoyable, you know, if you just realize that they're meant to be enjoyed. You know, there are lots of difficult poems out there. There's no doubt about that. There are a lot of poems that work from an aesthetic of, you know, whatever high art is supposed to be, in which you have to struggle with the reading. But I have to say, for me, that's not the kind of poetry that I gravitate towards. And there's an awful lot of poetry that I can gravitate towards. And that's the poem that can be emotionally, intellectually perceivable with a first reading, but that deepens and deepens and deepens if you allow yourself to go back in again and again and reread.
Hmm. How did you select the poems that you suggested we talk about today?
Partially ones I thought would read well over the radio, and ones that had moved me, basically. Something that had moved me. I figured if it moved me, if it delighted me, it might do so for someone else, you know?
So I'd like to share.
Sharing, you know? The thing they teach in kindergarten, yeah. We're sharing here.
That's right.
And what could be better, really? I mean, what, you know, it's one of the nicest human impulses.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of poems where you have to maybe do a little work, you mentioned in the first, I think it was the first poem we heard today, you had to talk a little bit about Thomas Hardy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When there are references in poems that, you know, how would you recommend that we research that or find out what that's all about?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that the reference to Thomas Hardy, I mean, I have to confess this, but I've never read a novel by Thomas Hardy. That's a terrible thing to confess. I've read a lot of 19th century fiction, but not Hardy's. But I do know a little about him, and I don't know the story of his death, you know. But for me, not really knowing that information, but simply knowing Thomas Hardy, mm-hmm. important writer, buried in Westminster, I could follow that story without any trouble. I didn't need to go to an encyclopedia or a biographical reference or anything of that sort. I think some poems, however, do make the mistake of giving too much private information that leaves the reader outside. You know, no one likes to feel as if the door is locked and they can't get in, especially if someone's saying, come on in, you know. And I have been myself at poetry readings where the poets introduce a poem, and they're delightful. You know, they go on and on. They have wonderful stories to tell, and they say, you might want to know about this, and you might want to know about that. And then they tell another funny story, and then they read the poem, and it's like 7 lines long. It's terrible. It's just boring. And if I hadn't had that 5-minute preamble, never would have had a clue as to what was going on in the poem. But I think that's just bad writing. I think that's writing that doesn't show respect for the reader. And I think any writing that doesn't show respect for the reader, that doesn't challenge, but at the same time welcome, you know, and make it possible for any ordinary person with a reasonable amount of intelligence and goodwill to come into a piece of writing and say, ah, I understand that. I can approach that. I can feel what's going on in that poem is a mistake in aesthetic. That's my aesthetic. I mean, there are lots of people who would argue with me about that, but I think writers mainly write to communicate. You know, that's why we do it. And if the communication fails in some way, you got to go back to the drawing board and rewrite.
Well, let's go back to Theodore Deppe.
Okay. You're not going to cry, are you?
No.
I'm sorry you said
that. I want to let the listeners know that at the beginning of the week, Philip dropped off an envelope full of these poems. Mm-hmm. And so I have been making my way through them. And last night I read Theodore Deppe's poems, the two that you sent, and I found myself just crying at this funeral march poem. And here's something else I discovered. And what I did was Harriet Williamson, my producer, she's so terrific.
Yeah.
So what she did is she went online and did a little research, and she printed out some information about the poets.
Okay, the poets.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so what I did was, and she clipped that information on top of the poem. Mm-hmm. So I had to rearrange that. I didn't want to know about the poet until
very, very good impulse, right?
Until I read the poem. And I was so struck with Theodore Deppe. I thought, this man is someone who has so much compassion for people. I thought, you know, and I wondered if he had worked in an asylum or in a hospital.
Yeah.
And sure enough,
he was a male nurse in a hospital for abused children. Yeah, and a lot of the poems in this collection, which I don't dare read over the radio, are about his experiences working with deeply, deeply damaged children, and they're unbelievably powerful.
Mm. And the title of this book is Cape Clear?
Mm-hmm. New and Selected Poems.
Yeah. Well, should we take a chance on this?
Let's take a chance on it, okay? Should I get the Kleenex over here for you? Okay, here's one. Here you go.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now this is called The Funeral March of Adolf Wölfli. I think that's how you pronounce the last name. And Wölfli was a patient in a mental hospital who is considered one of the greatest outsider artists. He obsessively in his room when he was institutionalized, just drew these amazing pictures. And I brought in a book, so if you lean in close to the radio, you'll be able to see them, examples of his writing, with great titles like The Great Railroad of the Canyon of Anger. And then he also wrote what looks kind of like music, but isn't, when you look really carefully at it, music notation that we understand. And virtually every square inch of any page is highly decorated. It's really, it's obsessive work, but obsessively beautiful in many ways. And this poem is based on the oral history of a woman named Lisa Becker, who was his nurse, the person who worked with him when he was in the hospital. So this is The Funeral March of Adolf Wölfli, from the oral history of Lisa Becker, taken in Bern, Switzerland, 1970. I found that art would keep him quiet. After breaking a fellow patient's wrist, he was isolated for years. I brought him colored pencils and newsprint, and he drew all day, or composed music in a system God revealed to him. For a time, he thought he loved me. For a time, my face appeared in every drawing he made. He wrote the Santa Lisa Polka for me, hardly danceable, but despite the homemade paper trumpet he hummed on, haunting, and mine.
He said once, if I married him, he'd abdicate his kingdom, write a waltz for me each day. Strange, then, after he died, to search in vain through his 8,000-page funeral march, looking for something, anything I could play before we buried him. His masterpiece reached to the ceiling of his cell, hand-sewn scores in which the music constantly gave way to drawings or ads for magazines. What might have been eighth notes floated above maps or rambling prayers, and then staves appeared with no notes at all. This was the work he'd cursed me for disturbing. The night before his funeral, I sorted through those composition books and found no sustained melody. But what did I expect? When he worked, he had a ritual of rolling up his shirt sleeves and trousers that took hours, interrupted by his voices. He'd start drawing in the margins and press inward, filling each space, singing to himself like a boy. Oh, he was more selfish than a child, incapable of loving anyone. I never told him I wasn't married. I took care of him 30 years, longer than most marriages last. Such a strange, ugly fellow, our yellow-fingered, warp-nailed one-man renaissance. He'd consume his week's supply of pencils in 3 days, then beg for more, against the doctor's orders I gave them. His march was signed, St. Adolph, Chief Musical Director, Painter, Writer, Inventor of 160 highly valuable inventions, Victor of mammoth battles, Giant Theater Director, Great God, Mental Patient, Casualty. In some ways I was relieved when he died, as if a blizzard finally howled away and I could start to shovel out. He didn't want to leave a few perfect works behind. He wanted to lift up everything, wanted to give the whole dying world lasting form. There were lucid moments when he knew he was mad. He could almost imagine what a normal life might be. I'd go home and practice piano every night. I'd play Beethoven, feel the moments things caught fire, but couldn't myself become flame. Page upon page of his march, containing, he said, everything and everyone he'd ever loved, and not a single tune I could play for his funeral, not even the Santa Lisa polka. We buried him without music. There is nothing I blame myself for more. We buried him without music, and for 2 weeks I took to bed. Then one night, it was snowing, I rolled up the sleeves of my nightdress. I pinned up the hem, then puzzled over a line of music that vanished in a field of painted irises, purple flags instead of notes, waving under a sky of sharps and flats. I closed my eyes and began to play. I didn't know what my hands were doing. Snow kept falling. Silences tumbled forward. Winged notes soared above chipped ivory keys. I played what I could of his funeral march. Imperfectly, of course. Only in fragments. I played the funeral march of Adolf Wölfli. Everything dark. Falling. Silver. I just love that part.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. It's so intense.
Yes. he gave a reading. He's actually a graduate of... And also, by the way, he went to high school with Bridget Kelly, he told me.
Hmm.
But he gave a reading at Vermont College this summer. And a lot of us went. He was the second person up. The first person was someone from the faculty who read. And... we didn't really, most people in the audience didn't know his work. He'd gotten his own degree from Vermont College and was coming back to read for selected poems. And within two poems, he had us. And we were transfixed, pinned, pinned to our seats by his poems. It was one of the best readings I'd ever been to.
Hmm. And now he lives in Ireland? Is
that... I think actually now he's in the States, but he's lived in Ireland for several years.
Hmm. Hmm. And here's an instance where I didn't know, you know, who Adolf Wölfli was,
mm-hmm.
but I was sure there, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I'm saying? And when you came into the studio this afternoon, you showed me
the pictures.
The pictures.
Did they look like what you might have imagined them to look like?
No.
Oh, okay. But that's okay,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have done that. You should have had your own funeral march of Adolf Hofli, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. No, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I don't know. I don't know if it would be useful for us to have some annotation in a book of poems in the back, so that if you know you could sort of have a thought or two of the poet.
Why not? You know, just as long as you don't, as a poet or as a fiction writer, rely on it so that you know. So, well, the notes will explain everything because then the poem can't live on its own.
Well, then, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not what it should be, then.
That's what I would say. Some people will disagree.
Well, you and I are.
Yeah, we know what's right.
let's invite folks to give us a call this afternoon. I know that this is a program where people are just going to be, you know, tempted just to listen, and I think that's fine.
Yeah.
But if you'd like to make a comment, if you'd like to ask Philip a question, you can give us a call at 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Philip Graham, our guest this afternoon, he's here to talk with us about poetry, to share some poems that he is fond of, that he loves, that he, what's the right, how should I phrase that? that he really appreciates?
Yeah, you know, that poems that have gotten under my skin.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
And Philip joins us from time to time here on the Afternoon Magazine. Mostly, I think we've talked about poetry.
We have, yeah.
Yeah, and then Focus 580, you are
a bit of everything.
A little bit of everything, fiction, nonfiction. And that program comes up every now and then.
Yeah.
It's not a regularly scheduled program.
No, just whenever they remember us. Tanya Liotsakos and I, she's one of the managers that Pages Fully just comes in and we do our thing together. I'd like to read a poem, actually a different poem from the one I was intending to read, because I just, you know, I was going over this book and thinking, oh man, how can I not read this and this and this? But this is from New and Selected Poems in the Black Window by Michael Van Walligen, who is a colleague of mine here, teaches in the program, who has taught for many, many years. And this is a collection of new poems. I was going to read one of those, and then poems from his other five books, and it's a wonderful representation of, you know, I think really the wonderful poetry that this colleague of mine, Michael, writes. Just the wonderful poems, and very powerful, and a clean line, and direct, and also very complex at the same time. And this is a poem, you don't have a copy of this, called The Spoiled Child. The spoiled child sits quiet as a mouse and learns to deserve everything he gets. It's Christmas Eve, so naturally his father kicks the electric train tracks, station cars and all, across the living room. Next he'll wrestle the goddamn son-of-a-bitch Christmas tree right out of the house. And furthermore, if there's any more crying, any more talking back, the spoiled child is going to get it again with the strap. The spoiled child is exhausted by all this and lies down in his bed like a dog. His sleep is full of yips and moans, but he is not a dog, not at all. There's simply been an accident of sorts, a train wreck, it turns out. Wreckage scattered everywhere, shouts, the breaking of glass. Then the night-long high-pitched whistling of the broken boiler, the cruel absolute zero of deep space. Live steam condensing into stars, galaxies, the permanent blizzard of the universe. Just before the true dawn, still bright, still there at this chilly latitude, the Star of Bethlehem sits low on the horizon, appearing as a tiny moon or some far light leaking from a bedroom keyhole. God has placed it there, beyond all accident, the spoiled child thinks. And beyond all accident, he hears the herald angels singing each to each. They sound like bitter wind, the cold labyrinth of home creaking in the wind, dogs, the knocking of pipes,
the ragged, high-pitched snoring of the magi, the fitful shepherds, even the drunken minotaur, uncomfortable on the couch in his human body. And, you know, I mean, there is a, in three pages, as powerful a representation you can offer of a terrifying childhood. And another thing, too, is that, you know, poetry talks about the deepest, most serious, sometimes the most frightening things, and does it in such concentrated language that it forces us to open our eyes. And it forces us through the empathy of the writer to find empathy inside ourselves, I think.
You said you had thought you would read something else, but you selected that one instead. How come?
Well, I was going over the poems. I mean, the thing was, it's hard because this is selected poems, you know, and I was thinking, well, I want to do one of the new ones, you know, because there are new poems in here. But then I just came upon one of my other favorites, so I said, oh, you know, what am I going to do? So, you know, but I could read that one. But we have a couple of the people here. Are we running out of time?
We're getting close. We have maybe time for one more poem. And before we do that, I want to let folks know who are listening that the names of these poets and the poems, the collection that we're taking these poems from, the titles of the books and the poet's name and the press will be on our website.
Yeah.
So go to wyll.uyuc.edu, then go to the Afternoon Magazine, and then go to This Week. And if it's not there now, it will be there within the next 24 hours, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because I know that people... Otherwise, we're going to get calls.
Okay.
So, okay, what else do you have for us?
Well, I have only two poems. Maybe I can fit them both in. They're short poems. This is, again, by another colleague, Michael David Medonic. It's actually a newish poem. It's called Snake, and it's originally published in the New England Review a couple years ago. And it's about a snake, but, well, it's not as simple as that. Snake. Assume it is effrontery in a sheath. A kind of repulsiveness that takes an inward thrust. A breathing so labored in armor and in muscle that it ejects its tongue repeatedly because it cannot keep a secret. Nor can it see or hear so well as it can test, like some fleshy tuning fork, the air for the mouse, who only feet away is stunned into roundness, its eyes disbelieving that the end is coming on no toes across a skein of sequins toward the heat. Old as the apple, yet varied as sin, it wants whatever makes it large, and yet it is its own chink, a slothy thing, who after it has taken blood lies like bloom on some shade lounge of the smart, or jabba, bemused by only the music it finds correct. Eat this, you wily, humorous slug, for here's the mouse that in your girth will lay you bare, my bone, my shadow, that slows you to a perfect pace for some smarter bird, that sharp-shinned raptor of the purest air. I like that a lot. First of all, it's a beautiful description of a real snake, skein of sequins, you know, moving toward the heat. All that's very beautiful. But then, it also seems to be about perhaps a human relationship of, you know, you think you've got me, but even if you do, you're going to be slowed down, and someone else is going to get you. You know, I mean, the thing about it is that you could read anything into this. You could see it not only as a little drama out there in the natural world, but something a little more complex in the human world as well that's being spoken of through, well, the imagery of the natural world.
Mm. Old as the apple, yet varied as sin.
Mm-hmm. I'd love that, yeah.
Yeah. Also, I like the comparison. We've got Bloom and Jabba.
Yeah.
Jabba the Hutt.
Oh, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Boy.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun to run across that. That's like unexpected,
yeah, right. you know? Yeah, like, yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah. Why can't poem have somebody from Star Wars in it, right?
You know?
And it works perfectly. Everybody knows who Jabba is. You don't even have to say the hut, you know. Jabba is now known by his first name. Yeah, he's like Madonna.
Yeah. Poor Bloom, though. May or may not be known.
Yeah, it could be the Bloom of Bloomsday, mm-hmm. you know, or it could be Harold Bloom, you know. You choose.
I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there.
Can I do
one
more?
With that question.
Just one more? So teeny-weeny?
Teeny-weeny one.
Okay.
Really teeny-weeny one.
Well, and I'll do it because this is called Regrets, and I regret that this hour is over. This is by another colleague from Vermont College, Natasha Saye, called Regrets. I regret I sleep so much that my body makes demands I do not refuse. I regret my 30s, unreasonable as crabgrass, and I regret the two vertical lines between my brows, the manifestation of my anxieties, which, of course, I also regret. I regret the Swiss milk pitcher broken by the neighbor's cat, and I regret my soft teeth. I regret nights I stayed awake baking or reading novels that changed me only momentarily. I regret that capitalism is my religion and the small red purse I do not use. I regret lying in the sun as a teenager and not putting a safety catch on my grandmother's brooch. I regret the poisoned dish of lacquered duck in 1977 and the squirrel that last year got caught in a rat trap. I regret the Procrustean bed of my job and having no columbine seeds from the beds by the old library. I regret the demise of the streetcar and the perils of color and that in my sleep I do not dismantle silence. Oh, my great lake of regrets, my body a floating island.
Natasha Saye from Bend, and writer Philip Graham, that will have to do it for today.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Oh, my pleasure. We'll look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
It is 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Ah, Todd Gleason here today.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Todd.
You know, I don't regret that you called me Dave Dickey, but I bet that some will regret that the numbers I have to report today, unreasonable as crabgrass as they may be, actually that was a beautiful line, are lower at the Board of Trade. Let's take a look at those numbers from the board. Here we go. September wheat futures, a high today of 308.5, a low at 304.25. Settlement price there at 305.75, and they were down a quarter on the day. December wheat, 321, the high, the low at 316. Settlement price at 318.75, down a quarter of a cent. The March futures, 332, the high, the low at 327. Settlement price at 329.5, down one. And the May futures, 336, the high, the low at 331. Settled 333, a penny and 3/4 lower. In July futures, 339 in the wheat pit for the high, the low at 335. A settlement price at 335.5, down 2.75. I forgot to tell Celeste Quinn that I was back after a little hiatus with my kids over the last 3 days before they got started at school this morning. And we're thinking about having a celebration that we will not regret this weekend because of that. Corn futures, September contract, 227.75. The high, the low at 224.75. Settled 225.25, down 2.75. December, 236.75. The high, the low at 233.5. Settled at 234, down 3 cents in the March contract. Now 244.75. The high, the low at 241.25. Settled 242.25, down 2.75. May contract in the corn pit, 250. The high, the low at 247. Settlement price at 247.5, down 3. In the July, 254.5. High, low at 251.25. Settlement there at 252, down 2.75. December corn for next year, 259.5. The high, the low at 256. Settlement at 256.75, and they finished off 3.75 for the day. Oats, September contract, 141.5, the high, the low at 139.5, and a settlement price there at 139.75, down 2 cents. December oats, 149.25, the high, the low at 147, settled 147.25, and they were down 2. Soy complex was mostly lower today with the far deferred. November's actually up just a bit. They were up 0.75 cents. By the way, if you're in the Effingham area in Newton, which is just due east of Effingham, you might want to drop by the center there, the Civic Center, community center rather, to see Dave Dickey tonight. He's probably on the road fairly quickly to head down there for a 7 o'clock WILL Ag Outlook meeting. That's this evening at the community center in Newton, Illinois. And you can pick up all the kinds of things that you hear a little bit here on WILL in greater detail this evening. Paul Cooley will be there along with a whole slew of other analysts. And once again, that's tonight at 7. Now, the soy complex, September beans, 626 and a half, the high, the low at 614 and a half. Settlement price there at 616 and three quarters. They were down 6.5 cents. November beans at the board, 616 the high, the low at 604 and a half. Settled 606 and a half, down six. And the Jan, 621 the high, the low at 610. Settled 611 and three quarters, 6 1/4 lower. March futures, 625 and a half high, low at 616. Settled 617 and a half, down 6.5. And the May futures, 625 and a half, the high, the low at 618. Settled 619 and a half, down 6.5. The only gainer in the bean pit today, November for next year, 598 the high, the low at 94, and a settlement price at 96.5, and they were up 3/4. Bean meal futures, 194 the high, the low at 185.10. Settled 185.80, they were down 8.20. The October, 183.50, the high, the low at 178.10, settled 178.20, down 4.80 for the day. September bean oil, 25.45, the high, the low at 24.55, settled 24.92, they were off 27, and the October was up to 24.60, the high, the low at 24.15. October bean oil settled 2 higher at 24.45, that's 2 cents higher. And that's a look at the numbers from the Board of Trade. Here's Celeste Quinn, the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
And another lower day today for livestock prices. August feeder cattle, 118.40, the high, 118.20, the low, 118.27 and a half, the settlement, that down 10. September, 113.45, the high, 111.90, the low, 112 even, the settlement, that down 117 and a half. October, 110.50, the high, 109.05, the low, 109.22 and a half, the settlement, that down $1. August live cattle, 83.35, the high, 82.55, the low, 82.82 and a half, the settlement, that down 30. October, 83.90, the high, 82.92 and a half, the low, the settlement, 83.05, that down 50. October lean hog, 64.20, the high, 62.82 and a half, the low, the settlement, 62.97 and a half, that down 35. December, 61.95, the high, 60.95, the low, 61.17 and a half, the settlement, that down a nickel. February, 61.25, the high, 60.45, the low, 60.70, the settlement, that down 25. April, 60.45, the high, 60 even, the low, and the settlement, that down 40. And August bellies, 93.70, the high, 93.55, the low, 93.55, the settlement, that up $2.85. The Dow is off 4 points at 10,178. The NASDAQ down 7 at 1854. The S&P 500 off a fraction at 1105.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Natural Gourmet, Champaign; Prairie Boat Works, Champaign; and Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning in Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Lee Davis from Northport, Alabama writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I live in Alabama, which is as far from California as one can possibly be. Why are we in Alabama having earthquakes like the 4.9 we got recently?"
Anyone who's spent much time in Southern California knows it has more in common with Oklahoma and Alabama.